Hi, everybody, and welcome to Context Countdown. I'm Andrew Kripko, and I'll be going over five recent news stories that need to be placed in context. Some of them are misleading, while others are spot on, but either way, there's a context behind them, and I'm here to tell you what's really going on. Let's take a look at our top five countdown for the week. At number five, we have Saudi Arabia's quest to become the next hotspot for Russian and Chinese tourists. The CEO of the Russian Direct Investment Fund lauded the socio-cultural openings undertaken in the kingdom under Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman's ambitious Vision 2030 program of far-reaching reforms, telling journalists that Riyadh will invest in Russia's tourism sector, but also wants more Russians visiting the country as well. Furthermore, he importantly noted that the Russian Chinese Saudi Fund will also make investments into tourism in Saudi Arabia with backing from the Saudi government, showing that the two OPEC plus great powers also want to bring the People's Republic on board too, which is sensible enough when considering that Chinese tourists are the biggest spenders in the world. The RDIF CEO also spoke very highly about Saudi Arabia's only UNESCO World Heritage Site in Al Ula, which could contribute to the kingdom's tourist renaissance after it relaxes its previously strict visa regulations and finally opens up to foreigners in the near future. When combined with MBS's other sociocultural reforms, such as allowing music to be played in restaurants, opening up cinemas, and letting women drive, it's very possible that people from all across the world might be interested in seeing these fast-moving transformations in person during their next vacation, especially if the Saudi government heavily marketed the kingdom and possibly subsidize some of its tourist packages. Given the context of this analysis, it's very likely that Riyadh will work closely with its new partners in Moscow and Beijing to promote its tourist industry to Russians and Chinese alike, especially seeing as how both of their governments will be jointly investing in these ventures. This is strategically important because it speaks to the growing closeness between these three countries and how their political relations are finally trickling down to the people-to-people level of intercultural exchanges. In addition, many Saudis will also be interacting with Russians and Chinese for the first time too, which could turn out to be a valuable cultural experience that might make them more interested in those two countries. It should also be kept in mind that it won't just be average Russians and Chinese taking vacations in Saudi Arabia, but some of the wealthy elite as well, who might in turn be inspired to invest further in the previously untapped tourism industry there, or even some of the country's other new projects, such as the NEOM Future City. Therefore, Saudi Arabia's strategic courting of Russian and Chinese tourists and the joint investments that these three governments have committed to in this regard will help to take the relation to the next step and facilitate the kingdom's overall diversification away from its former American patron and towards the emerging multipolar world order. The next one up is the new Salvadoran president promising to reassess relations with China. The Secretary General of President-elect Nayib Bukele's New Ideas Party told his countrymen that their new leader will reconsider his government's relations with China, which is surprisingly recognized last August after breaking relations with long-term ally Taiwan in exchange for what was later revealed to have been $150 million of aid from Beijing. Reuters quoted the official as saying that, "With the issue of China-Taiwan relations, we have to study them and put them in the balance. What is best for the nation, not what is best for a political party, as the outgoing administration did. We were not consulted, nor did they give us the reasons for establishing relations with China. Now we have to investigate in detail." End quote. Observers predicted that something of this sort might happen, considering that the political outsider vowed to radically change his country's traditional two-party system in every way possible, which would naturally include reevaluating the previous government's foreign policy and possibly changing some of it on the pretext that some decisions might have been conducted for corrupt reasons, like Bukele's close advisor hinted. Everything should be put into its proper domestic and international context, however, because things aren't as clear-cut as they might appear. While outsiders might somewhat rightly suspect that Bukele is doing the U.S.'s bidding, after Washington fear-mongered about the game-changing consequences of El Salvador's so-called defection last year, the country's new leader was nevertheless democratically elected in a landslide after winning the first round of voting earlier this month, shattering the Central American state's two-party system with his populist promises to go after corruption and restore his nation's dignity. That said, Salvadorans are largely concerned with their many domestic problems that have pushed over a quarter of the population into mostly illegally migrating to the U.S., suggesting that they'll go along with their new leader's foreign policy as long as it brings economic dividends to the country. While anything can happen in the less than 4 months before Bukele takes office on the 1st of June, it's very possible that he might be approached by the U.S. with an offer that he can't refuse to reverse the current government's decision in exchange for hefty amounts of economic aid that could be touted as proof of him delivering on his promise to improve his people's livelihood. Of course, he'll probably only do this if the sum that's offered is more than China's promised $150 million, though the U.S. could match or even go below that amount by threatening to massively deport the many illegal Salvadorans on its territory if he refuses, on the pretext that they're linked to the infamous MS-13 drug gang. That possibly being the case, China might realistically lose its Central American foothold later this year. Third on our countdown is the Libyan National Army's surprisingly successful southern campaign. General Khalifa Haftar of the unrecognized East Libyan government in Tobruk announced the beginning of his forces' operations against terrorist groups, foreign rebels, mercenaries, and other non-state actors in southern Libya last month, sweeping across this broad expanse of sparsely populated territory in the time since to finally capture the country's biggest oil field of El Sharara without a shot earlier this week. There were fears that another conventional phase of the country's long-running civil war would break out as the LNA approached areas under the nominal control of militia forces loyal to the internationally recognized and Tripoli-based Government of National Accord. But Haftar's army apparently cut a deal with the defenders of the El Sharara oil field to prevent the scenario from transpiring. The renegade general is now the most powerful military force in the country, with the greatest control over Libya's economic lifeblood, though he hasn't abused his position because he vowed to return control of its energy infrastructure to the National Oil Company, a pragmatic move if there ever was one, since international sanctions prohibit him from selling its resources on the global market anyhow. Nevertheless, he's able to present himself as the nation's liberator and only unifying force in the post-Gaddafi chaos that followed NATO's 2011 regime change against the Jamahiriya, thus improving his chances to clinch the presidency if he decides to run in the country's elections later this year. While Saif Gaddafi might give him a run for his money, people would be voting for Muammar Gaddafi due to nostalgia, while Haftar actually has real accomplishments under his belt. Having previously been kept out of power due to the international lobbying efforts of the Tripoli-based GNA, Haftar might finally be able to cut a deal with it and the rest of the global community to be recognized as a legitimate political force following his military's astounding success in the south and the peaceful return of the El Sharara oil field to the NOC. At the same time, however, the GNA might hold out in the mistaken belief that the rest of the world will unite against Haftar, though that probably won't happen, since he has different degrees of tacit backing from Egypt, the UAE, and some even say France and Russia as well. Furthermore, the GNA's motley crew of competing militias can't even properly control Tripoli, so any international support for them is superficial as it is. It appeared for a while that Libya was destined for Balkanization, but Haftar's sudden rise to power and especially his latest successes in the south have shown that even the most broken of African countries has a chance at reuniting in some way or another, preferably through peaceful means brought about as a result of political compromise. Civil war-torn Libya has never been closer to reunification, but it'll now be up to Tripoli's international backers to pressure the GNA into cutting a deal with Haftar for the sake of the entire nation, though one that might nevertheless still be difficult to reach for reasons of ego and geopolitics. Failing that, Haftar might slowly but surely tighten the noose that he strung around Tripoli's neck until the authorities there surrender, though he seems to be doing everything that he can to reach an acceptable accommodation before that happens. Our runner-up is the tit-for-tat expulsion of the Polish and Norwegian consuls. Also ordered Polish consul Sławomir Kowalski to leave the country due to what it said were numerous complaints about his behavior being unbecoming of a diplomat, while Warsaw said that it would respond in kind, and a rare sign of tension between these two long-running allies. Reports suggest that Kowalski was helping Polish families keep their children after Norway's ultra-liberal child protection services threatened to take them away from their homes for typically exaggerated reasons, such as small bruises caused by their siblings or other such examples that the state supposedly believes is proof that their parents abused them. The Scandinavian country has long been known for its radical approach towards this issue and would surely see Poland's efforts to resist it as interference in its domestic affairs, despite it being Warsaw's diplomatic duty to protect its citizens abroad from discrimination. It's important to note that Poles are the largest minority group in Norway, and that Poland is one of the country's main export destinations, especially for energy and defense products, the first mention of which is slated to increase in the future following the construction of the so-called Baltic Pipe. This means that both countries are caught up in a system of complex economic interdependence that could either stabilize this dispute or worsen it, depending on how either party acts in the coming future. Seeing as how Polish Prime Minister Mateusz Morawiecki said last month that his country will continue protecting the rights of Poles abroad, Kowalski's expulsion from Norway will probably not stop Poland's diplomatic activities in support of families unjustly discriminated against by the Norwegian authorities, thus suggesting a continuation of this diplomatic crisis. Neither Norway nor Poland want to back down in this dispute because of how important of an issue they regard this as being, with both countries considering it to be both a matter of prestige and sovereignty, the latter being national and personal, respectively. Oslo feels offended that Polish migrants are supposedly violating its super strict national laws against suspected child abuse, while Poland believes that its citizens are unfairly having their lives ruined and their families torn apart because of the selective application of ultra-liberal policies against them. This sentiment is made even worse by the state avoiding the scourge of female genital mutilation by Muslim minority communities due to political correctness. As such, Kowalski is seen as a scoundrel by his Norwegian host. His own Polish people regard him as a hero who did the right thing for the right reasons. At our top spot, we've got President Putin's Great Society program. The Russian government announced it'll commit approximately $390 billion to implementing President Putin's May decrees that he issued following his re-election last year on a promise to revitalize the domestic economy and finally deliver tangible benefits to the majority of the population, especially those outside of the main cities of Moscow and St. Petersburg who've barely seen much of their livelihoods improve over the past two decades. This visionary initiative is being called the Great Society Program and will consist of 12 national projects that run the gamut of everything from agriculture to industry to transportation infrastructure and all that's in between, with specific emphases also being placed on ecology, education, and the digital economy. It's not an exaggeration to say that the Great Society will be President Putin's ultimate legacy to his people and is long overdue, though the requisite funds probably couldn't be procured prior to this moment until Russia finally mastered hypersonic missile technology last year and was able to responsibly divert hefty military-industrial funds to socioeconomic development projects after reliably ensuring the country's security from all next-generation conventional threats. That would explain why President Putin unveiled these weapon systems at the tail end of his campaign speech, preaching the detailed need for domestic reconstruction in order to not fall behind Russia's many international competitors in the future, proving to his people that their country can finally afford to focus on this pressing issue. The implementation of the Great Society vision couldn't have come at a more convenient domestic political time either, after the Kremlin's controversial pension reform plan and the inevitable come down of the post-Crimean patriotic high began to hit the government's approval ratings. Kremlin advisor Vladislav Surkov's best-intended efforts to recently articulate a lasting ideology that he says will endure after the Russian leader's final term in office ends in 2024 were met with a rebuttal from popular philosopher Alexander Dugin, who predicted that drastic change was inevitable. But both patriotic men's visions might converge with the planned conclusion of President Putin's Great Society program by that time. On the one hand, the success of this ambitious initiative would reinforce the political system that President Putin pioneered while on the other, it would also catalyze far-reaching socioeconomic changes after fulfilling Russia's geostrategic destiny as the Eurasian land bridge. The end result of the Great Society could be a hybrid state heavily influenced by both Surkov and Dugin's ideas, one which continues the path that President Putin placed it on, but also takes it in exciting new domestic and international directions. While it's impossible to predict with any degree of accuracy what this might look like in practice by that time, one can be sure that Russia will do its utmost to strike the best balance between all opportunities. All right, folks, there you have it. This wraps up this week's edition of Context Countdown. And as I always do, I want to warmly thank each and every one of you for tuning into my program. Hope you all tune in again next week and have a nice rest of your week. Thank you. Bye.